Lori, over to you.
Well, thank you all very much indeed for coming. Can you hear me clearly at the back? Thank you. It is a very intimidating room to be addressing. I can see there seems to be an increasing phenomenon in my life. A number of my bosses sitting in the room from previous parts of my life, and many, many people in the room who know a great deal more about Afghanistan than I do. I was last in Kabul on Thursday, and then flew to Canada and just landed from Canada this morning. So I apologize if I'm a little bit confused as I talk. And I suppose what I'm really here to do is to try to share a little bit of my confusion and to take advantage of some of the expertise in this room to have more of a conversation than a pontification. What many of you will have found in your visits to Afghanistan recently is there is an astonishing gap between the kinds of experience that appears to be happening in Helmand, the kind of language of the British and American military, which is predominantly at the moment quite cautiously optimistic, and the sentiment around Kabul, around the NGO community, and around many of the civilians, which is much more gloomy. These same sorts of schizophrenic dichotomies exist in Pakistan as well, where it seems to me, and again this is really one person's experience rather than a great final statement on the matter, but many, many of the Pakistanis that I saw last week seem to be privately extremely doubtful about our operations in Afghanistan, while publicly speaking a very fine line about the global war on terror and the importance of crushing the Taliban. So it's a very, very odd dichotomy, and it's one that I want to explore a little bit more. In other words, if I sit down with ex-director generals, the ISI, for example, of whom I saw two last week, they will say privately, we're not quite sure what the United States thinks it's doing in Afghanistan. And they'll speculate, is it something to do with China? Is it something to do with having strategic bases? Is it something to do with gas? But in public, when talking to the United States, we'll say, we fully understand that the security of Pakistan depends on Afghanistan and is vital to crush the Taliban. The two central questions, though, as we look at this issue, are, firstly, why do we think we're there? You know, what is it we're trying to achieve? Why do we think this place is important? And secondly, what can we do? And these two things are distinct. We often confuse them. We often assume if something is really, really important, it must be possible to do it. Right? We don't like the idea that there could be something that we really cared about, something that really mattered, which we might be unable to do. My guess is, and this is preempting what I'm about to say, that of course Afghanistan does matter, but perhaps not as much as we imagine. Right? It's not an irrelevant place. It's a place that has certain kinds of significance. We have certain kinds of obligations to the Afghan people. Afghanistan does pose some kind of threat to regional stability. But it is only one country amongst many, perhaps in a category of 20 or 30 countries to whom we have those forms of responsibility or which pose those kinds of threats. And as for what we can do about it, again, the answer isn't entirely black and white. It's not that we can do absolutely nothing and that rather than cutting and running, we must just run. But nor is it true that we're likely to be able to create a legitimate, effective, credible Afghan government and leave behind the kind of stability of which we once dreamt. All of that seems like platitudes because, as you heard from the speaker as he introduced me, we are very accustomed to having said over the last 5-6 years, we're being more realistic. In fact, actually, I'm going to be unfair to the speaker who introduced me and just deconstruct what he said in introducing me, because I think it represents now very much the central theme of British descriptions of Afghanistan. It's a very, very good summary of where I think we've arrived over the last 5 years. So as you remember, the speaker said, firstly, that we have moved away from the fantasies of democracy building towards more realistic expectations. That we have now properly supported and equipped our troops. That they now feel cautiously optimistic. That we are moving into negotiations with the Taliban. And the question is, will the Taliban or will they not defend the rights of women? Almost all of these statements, unfortunately, can be questioned. It is true indeed that we have gone from where I was in 2002 when I sat in rooms like this and heard people say every Afghan is committed to a gender-sensitive, multi-ethnic, centralized state based on democracy, human rights, rule of law, to the point at which President Obama arrived last year, where he talks about a credible, effective, and legitimate Afghan government. So, certainly the language, the rhetoric, appears to have become more realistic. Unfortunately, even that more realistic rhetoric of a credible, effective, legitimate Afghan government is likely to be out of our reach. As for the statement that we are supporting and equipping our troops properly, well, that too, to some extent, is true. It's certainly true that the British military in particular and the American military, even more dramatically, were extremely dissatisfied with the troop numbers and the resources given to them from 2005 to 2009. The British story is very well known. Discussions about helicopters and the gradual transition that took us from roughly 300 special forces sitting in a base in Helmand in 2005, so quite recently, to 3,000, to 5,000, to 7,000, to 9,000, to 10,000, and to today, 31,000 soldiers in that same province of Helmand, up from 300 in 2005. And it is true that we have also become better at providing helicopters and military equipment. And on the American side, the story even more dramatic. President Obama often appears to be a man who is somewhat reluctant and moderate in his approach. And that's certainly true rhetorically, but in actual fact, the contribution that President Obama has made to troop numbers and resources in Afghanistan far outstrips that of the much more hawkish and melodramatic President Bush. President Bush talked a huge game, but in fact only increased troop numbers in Iraq by about 30%. President Obama took over a situation in January of 2008 when the American troop numbers were under 50,000, committed a further 17,000, then a further 30,000. So American troop numbers are now, with their coalition allies, up at about the 120,000 level. So that's certainly right. We have a much better equipped and much better resourced military. And what I observed in Helmand this week is very, very high morale. Right, soldiers who feel that at last they have got the right kinds of inputs and resources to do the job. The British in particular, who have given up on the much nastier parts of the province. So some of you in this audience I know were fighting in Sangin, and of course we have moved out of Sangin. The American Marine Corps has now taken over Sangin. We're now focused around Lashkar Gah with about 10,000 soldiers dealing with an area which I guess is about 62 kilometres across, from Nadi Ali across to Goreshk, where the Danes are. And with the very large troop numbers that we have there, about 10,000 people in this rather small area, we have begun to grow the ink spots. We've begun to connect some of the roads, not entirely. It's still not possible, actually, to drive from Lashkar Gah up to Goreshk, let alone drive safely from Kandahar towards the Iranian border. But there has been a small increase, as you would expect. Right, you would expect, if you put 30,000 troops into Helmand, right, which has a population of, I suppose, 800,000 people, very difficult to tell because of Afghan statistics, but approximately 800,000 people, to give you a comparative indicator, when I was in Misan in southern Iraq, which had an almost identical population size, in 2003-2004, we had one battle group. We had approximately 1,100 troops dealing with an area with a population size in which we now have 30,000. So, as you would expect, some improvements in Helmand. And that optimism extends to General Petraeus and to DCOM ISAF and to some extent to the Secretary of Defense and to the Secretary of State, all of whom feel that they're beginning to make progress. They are killing a lot of mid-level Taliban commanders. They are feeling that bazaars are opening, people are able to move through the streets. They are optimistic about the new achievements in training the Afghan National Army and the Afghan National Police. The whole counterinsurgency theory, with which you're all familiar, but for those of you in the audience who are not familiar, which is roughly a theory of clear, hold and build, in other words, a theory whereby international troops go into this area, clear out the bad guys, hold the ring, bring in the Afghan government, get the economy going again, get governance going again, hand over to the Afghan army, then the Afghan police, and move on outwards. This seems to be happening in the areas where we have very large numbers of troops. At the same time, if you are to talk to almost anybody in Kabul, almost anybody working in an NGO, a charity, or in a civilian organization, they are worried and depressed. I was in Kabul, as I said last week. I was there also 3 weeks ago. I did not meet a single civilian in Kabul who thought that things were going well. From their point of view, the situation is deteriorating. Just to give you an anecdotal example, the director of the Aga Khan Microcredit Bank was complaining that they have been unable to open 17 branches of their bank in northern Afghanistan. There is a sense that it's like a water balloon. As we squeeze Helmand, the problem is popping up somewhere else. In particular, roads which used to be entirely safe, going from Kabul up to Mazar-e-Sharif or out to Kunar, are now impossible to travel down for any normal civilian. And despite the very large military presence in Helmand or Kandahar, I would not recommend any of you getting in a taxi to Helmand at the moment. Right? The improvement is there, but let us look at what this improvement really is. Let's get down to the brass tacks, right? We talk a lot about educational improvements in Helmand. There have been serious educational improvements in Helmand. The number of children in school in Helmand has gone from approximately 50,000 in 2005 to approximately 80,000 in 2010. That is a great developmental achievement. But it is not a step change. That move from 50,000 to 80,000 is not a total transformation. And the question is, of course, as with all these things, how sustainable is it? Let us look at police training. I went to see the police training in Helmand. The police training, which is very, very impressive, and is currently being run by a battle group from the Argyles, involves Afghan local policemen coming in on an 8-week course and then graduating and going back to their villages as policemen. What is an 8-week course? An 8-week course means taking people of whom they estimate 92%, the colonel actually estimated 95%, but then revised to 92%, are entirely unable to read and write when they enter that course. They cannot write their names, they cannot recognize numbers up to 10, they have never been to school. If you take people in their 20s and 30s who have never been to school and put them through an 8-week course, they find it very difficult to concentrate in classrooms. We are now focusing on basic literacy. We give them 64 hours of basic literacy, which is about 2 weeks of their 8-week course. At the end of that, the brighter students are able to read at the level of a 5-year-old. In other words, they can write their names and they can count up to about 100, recognize numbers up to about 100. And we give them some basic weapons training. They can clean their weapons. And we talk a little bit about police training and then we put them back in the villages. I am not sure whether what I have just described is a policeman. Right? And the reason I'm being a little bit pedantic about these kinds of things is that when you hear these great claims about massive achievements in police training or military training, it is quite important to ask questions about exactly how long those courses are and exactly what skills they are emerging with. At the base of the whole thing, the base of the whole anxiety that everybody feels, an anxiety which expresses itself, of course, in this question about negotiating with the Taliban, is the fear that we are not creating anything sustainable. Where the blame rests on this hardly matters. I am tempted to say, and everybody in this room would be tempted to say, that the blame does not rest with us. Right? There is very good reason for us to feel that the British military in particular has done a very good job. If it is not sustainable, we tend to say, and we can understand why we like to say these things, it's not our fault, it's the fault of the Afghan government. Or it's not our fault, it's the fault of Pakistan. Who knows whether this is true? Whether it might not be partly our fault as well. But whether it is our fault, or whether it is simply that the Afghan government has failed to make the necessary progress and remains, in many ways, corrupt, unpopular, illegitimate, ineffectual, or whether it is that the government of Pakistan is failing to play its full role in securing the borders and excluding safe havens, or whether it is that the Afghan National Army is predominantly officered by Tajiks, and even when it has Pashtun soldiers, very few of them are southern Pashtun, and therefore their presence in provinces like Helmand is unlikely to be sustainable. Whatever the reasons are, after 8.5 years, we are not yet in a situation where anyone in this room would be comfortable walking away. Which is why we talk about negotiating with the Taliban. What do we mean by negotiating with the Taliban? We don't know. Right? We really do not know. Governor Mangal in Helmand said to me, negotiating with the Taliban is absolutely straightforward. All we need to do is crush them, kill their mid-level commanders, totally grind them into the ground, and then we will reconcile on the following terms. They disarm, they accept the Afghan constitution, and they break their links with Al-Qaeda. This is not a negotiation. This is a surrender. Right? And the question is, what are we actually doing? How much give have we got? What do these guys want? What are our levers? How do we control them? How do we bring them to the table? It is these kinds of anxieties that make me feel that we need to be more realistic about our own capacity, our own limitations, what we cannot do. It is an academic issue why we haven't made much progress for 8.5 years, but the reality is we have not made much progress over 8.5 years. Anyone in this room can talk about the things we've done. It is true. There are now 2 million girls in school who were not in school earlier. There are now access to health clinics in the region of 85% in Bamiyan. We all know these statistics. We can all talk about them. But ultimately, Afghans are pretty depressed, civilians are pretty depressed, and people are rather doubtful about whether there is anything that's created in this country which is likely to fulfill our kinds of ambitions for Afghanistan. What then do we do? Well, if you're the Canadian government, and I've obviously... My slightly frenzied state reflects the fact that I've just got off the plane from Canada. But if you're the Canadian government, what you do is you say, enough. The Canadian government announced that in 2011, they cease combat operations. Their argument is, by then they've been on the ground for 10 years, they don't want to be dragged into the discussion about exactly why it didn't work, but it didn't work, and after 10 years, they're going to draw back. They've taken sacrifices, they've lost over 170 soldiers in Kandahar, they've fought very bravely, but the Canadian government has decided enough is enough. But the American government, and this is what really matters to us in the room, is in a very different situation. It appears from Bob Woodward's book that President Obama was very, very doubtful about the adventure in Afghanistan. Having set off during the election campaign saying, Iraq is the wrong war, Afghanistan's the right war, we must be in Afghanistan, it's an existential threat to American national security. By 2009, he began to be a little bit doubtful. And Woodward at least describes an astonishing confrontation between President Obama and his generals about troop deployments. At the end of this painful 9-week process in the fall of last year, President Obama agreed to send the additional 30,000 troops and then said that they would begin drawing down in July 2011. What does this mean? Is the president serious? Is he going to draw down? And what is Britain going to do? Let us imagine hypothetically that we in Britain thought that this thing was a bit of a mess. Our dream in this room would be that we remain shoulder to shoulder with the United States. Our dream would be we go in with the Americans, and as they withdraw, we withdraw with them. We never have to have any uncomfortable conversation in which the United States continues to do something which we're not doing. So the dream scenario, if hypothetically anyone in this room was skeptical about this whole event, The dream would be July 2011, President Obama begins to draw down, the British draw down with him, we're all out of combat operations by 2015, halas, right? But what if that doesn't happen? What if the United States, for whatever reasons, the midterm elections, the position of General Petraeus, in the end finds itself unable to extract American combat troops from Afghanistan by 2015? What if, just hypothetically, General Petraeus says, okay, I will remove 850 logistics people in July of 2011, but basically the surge is continuing through 2012. Or 2,000 soldiers out of 120,000. And why is he going to do this? Well, he's going to do this because he believes, as do many, many senior figures in the British military, that Afghanistan is an existential threat to global security. President Obama is being told by General Petraeus that there is a phenomenon called transnational global Islamic extremism, and that this phenomenon must be defeated in Afghanistan for a whole series of reasons, but chiefly, I suppose, for one. Chiefly for one. There are two subsidiary reasons. One of them is a fear that terrorists might return. And you occasionally hear that from senior British generals who say, if we withdraw from Afghanistan, there will be bombs at Stansted and bombs at Heathrow. The second subsidiary reason is some people believe the stability of Pakistan depends on Afghanistan. So if Afghanistan falls, some domino effect will ripple across. Mad mullahs will get their hands on nuclear weapons in Islamabad and the end of the world is nigh. But the real thing that concerns senior American generals, I believe, is American credibility. They're terrified at the thought that if they are perceived to have been defeated in Afghanistan, this will shake to the foundations the reputation of the superpower and empower and encourage Islamist extremists all over the world by this apparent victory. So for all these reasons, it seems to me that General Petraeus is likely to dig his heels in, and for all those reasons, I think it's going to be very difficult for President Obama to argue against him. Petraeus is the hero of Iraq, most celebrated American soldier since Eisenhower, with his own presidential ambitions, perhaps, in 2016. The president's already sacked two generals in quick succession and brought in Petraeus as his third. If Petraeus says he wants to stick with it, he believes in the strategy, counterinsurgency can work, give me some more time, have a bit of strategic patience here, the president is likely to sign off. In which case, what is Britain going to do? The Prime Minister has made it very, very clear that we are committed to ceasing combat operations by 2015. That does not mean that we leave entirely. We can keep special forces there. We can keep intelligence people there. We can continue to train the Afghan National Army and the Afghan National Police. But we are to cease combat operations by 2015. How are we going to get there? I personally think that is terrific. I think the Prime Minister is absolutely right. There needs to be a point where you say enough. And General Caldwell, who's the three-star who's training the Afghan National Army at the moment and the Afghan National Police, who again I saw on Thursday morning, is desperate for trainers, is begging us to send people to train his troops. I would have thought this is the most fantastic opportunity for Britain. Gives us an opportunity to stand up there and say, yep, we're volunteering for the training. We all agree that our exit strategy is through training, transition is through training, we must build up the Afghan National Army, the Afghan National Police, and we are shifting ourselves out of Helmand towards a training role by, let us say, 2013. But we do not yet have, as far as I can see, the plan in place to make that transition. I think there are many people in the military who will continue to want to have a two-star divisional command in Helmand when the American command ends. We will continue to fight to try to control the PRT, the Provincial Reconstruction Team in Lashkargah. And I haven't got any kind of insight into what our training is for 2013-2014, but I wouldn't be at all surprised to discover that our own military is still proposing to be conducting counterinsurgency operations in Helmand by 2013-2014. We need to now start having a conversation here in Britain about how we're going to shift towards that end of combat operations by 2015. Because what I don't think we want to be in a position of doing is being pinned on the ground in an American fight where American anxieties about credibility or domino theories or stretched global wars on terrorism are going to hold them on the ground longer than seems commensurate with our capacity, right? That very pompous phrase intended to mean, by 2015, we will have been there for 14 years. If we have not managed to achieve what we set out to achieve in 14 years, my guess is we're probably unlikely to ever achieve it. And at some point, we need to find a way of drawing a line under things. The question then for the room, and it's at this point I'm going to stop talking, open it up to questions, is how do we pragmatically, realistically, in a textured, detailed fashion, get Britain into a situation where we do not repeat the fiasco of Basra? We don't want to be humiliated again. We don't want to be in a situation again where, at very, very short notice, we pull the rug, the Americans think we're a bunch of wimps, they go in and clear up all our troubles, and we feel miserable. We've got 4 years to sort this out. 4 years to have a grown-up conversation in the United States to make sure that by the time we cease combat operations in 2015, they're ready for it, and we are performing an honourable role in intelligence, in special forces operations, and in training, but we need to do that now. Thank you very much indeed, and looking forward to questions and discussion. Thank you.
I'm sure you all agree that was a tour de force based on vast experience, not just in Afghanistan itself, but in Iraq. Questions for half an hour, and we'd make it a point of honour to finish at 2 o'clock, so may I please have the first question?